So I waggled with...
This is continuing with Merle Tuva on 21st December.
I waggled with the Beer Standards people to let us have on loan one of these Wurzburg antennas. Mm-hmm. We would make the frame. So we, two, three technicians, I designed, Howard and I designed an equatorial mount and ground some gears here and there, yeah. A differential from an old Crosley or some other crazy kind of little car, which we used for feeding in the tracking motion, and so on. And we set up this dish.
Was it equatorially mounted?
Equatorially mounted.
I see.
There are pictures of all this over at the lab if you ever get interested. And we put it right there on the campus at the DTM, right in the middle of town here. And we got pretty good records. We built this 50-channel vacuum tube set. And, of course, vacuum tubes have troubles. They would run down, dying and so on. Mm-hmm. Keeping amplitudes under control was quite a problem. But we got a lot of profiles. We, in fact, made with the Wurzburg, we made a complete study of all the sky that you can see from here. I think they're spaced some 5 degrees apart.
Points, 5 degree grid, yeah.
Yeah, 5 degree grid, something like that. Oh, in parts of the sky, I think it was a 10-degree grid. Way high up, there's nothing much interesting. And some places closer on the equator. This was in the late 50s. This was Howard Tatel and I and a couple of technicians. And then we had some fellows here for summer. George Field was one. And another chap, what's his name?
Was Bernie Burke involved in this?
Bernie Burke, let's see. We brought Bernie down. It's a little later. When was Burke there? We had, he was in the middle 50s. I had brought in Fireor, who's now head of NCAR, meteorology. I brought a Fireor from the University of Chicago, and one of the time, Bernie Burke, middle 50s.
Yeah, because 55 was the Jupiter discovery.
Yes. You see, in addition to the hydrogen thing, I said we've got to have really all sides of radio astronomy if we're going to do any of it. We've got to know about interferometers, too. So I arranged to rent a flat bottomland on a farm out 20 miles west of here along the Potomac. And we put up some arrays.
Mm-hmm.
First to look at the sun, and second, a pretty good array, about a half a mile long. Forgotten what frequency? 20 megacycles?
Yeah, 15 or 20, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was 20 megacycles. Which could be tilted. This had a crude parabolic reflector made of wires. And then the whole thing could be tilted at a given angle with respect to the ground.
I see.
It was an east-west array, and we phased it to look at the meridian overhead, and we could cock the altitude
right.
suit. This was the one on which Jupiter was found. Kind of funny. Yeah, Burke and Ken Franklin, who had come from California and was an astronomer, were set the job. Burke was a physicist. It was set the job to get what we can out of this array. Fireor was working on the solar array, which was a T or an L, and at a different frequency. So Fireor was running one array out there, and Burke was running the other, Franklin. And on Burke and Franklin's thing, there would be certain interference. Now, we'd had quite a lot of trouble with tractors around there, and some old cars, one thing or another. So we knew ignition noise comes in on the record every so often. You've got to keep track of what's happening. But there was one thing that would kept showing up around, this was August or September, something like that. It was showing up around 10 o'clock at night, and it got later. And we said, that's that crazy old Ford. There was an old Ford Model T, mind you.
Model T.
Maybe it was a Model A. I never saw it, but the boys described it, one of the farm laborers had out there, a whole wreck of the thing. And they knew that. They would go by several times a daytime, made a racket. And they'd see this fuss at 10 o'clock at night. This guy must be calling on his girl. And it got later. And then a couple of weeks later, they said, my God, it's quarter of 11. And so he must be, she's letting him stay. And then he'd got to be about 11:15. And he said, oh, this is getting hot. So we were watching this romance. And then to our surprise, it's moved back. We got to 10:30 and 10 o'clock and 9:30 and 9 o'clock. Well, it didn't make any sense. There's something wrong with the romance theory. So Ken and Bernie looked all around to find out what the hell this could be due to. And then Ken, I believe, or both of them, discovered that the retrograde motion of Jupiter corresponded exactly to the meridian they were set on.
Beautiful.
But we had before we dreamed of Jupiter, see, we were all kind of watching this romance. We thought of that crazy old Ford. Well, so this was an effort to qualify ourselves, to have some judgment about both interferometry and parabolic dishes work.
Let me ask you why you were particularly interested in the hydrogen line. Why did you... You apparently sort of grabbed onto that when it came out.
Well, it's very intriguing. To me, it's still very interesting because this is the stuff of which stars are made, and you're watching essentially the aggregates pulling together at a very early stage.
But was this your motivation at that time also?
Sure. Yeah. It's purely because it seemed more like astronomy than
in the previous
than a lot of it.
Radio astronomy.
More immediately associated with astronomical ideas, anyway, astrophysics ideas.
Yeah.
And it's basic. You see, protons have been. I've been hipped on protons
right,
from the beginning,
protons,
so it was kind of natural for me to be pushing the hydrogen.
Yeah, that's a very good tie-in, right?
And then we moved out to Derwent and changed to improve some of our circuits. But when we lost Bernie, of course, that was the big blow.
That was 60.
Meanwhile, you see, I was functioning as chairman for the NSF of the astronomy committee. And things like that. And this is part of the reason for making sure that you had some spurs, that you earned your own spurs.
Yeah.
And had first-hand knowledge and disappointments and so on. Otherwise, you just can't understand why research people have so much trouble getting results and, you know, and with each other and disagreeing and all that. You've got to have your hands dirty doing the same thing.
Exactly.
So this is part of the reason why I have always spent time in the lab taking my own beatings and doing my own crazy, dumb mistakes.
Just to stay in touch.
It keeps you humble.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
And this is why I was determined to have experience with making dishes and designing dishes and costs and tolerances and all the rest. Mm-hmm. And also keeping track of where the electronics was going so as to see what was important from the astrophysics standpoint and what was feasible from the electronic standpoint and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can't really function as an advisor.
No, that's right.
And this is again, half it. I recognize that I was an older man and an administrator, and my job is to try to make opportunities for others as best you could. But you can have some awfully bullheaded notions if you don't let yourself get trimmed down by first-hand experience with disappointments.
Right.
So that's a good deal of the reason why I was doing this.
But may I ask you, it seems to me that for the 5 or 10 years after the war, that the real lead in radio astronomy was held by England and Australia. How did this happen? The U.S. had such a huge radar establishment, and yet it didn't seem to follow it like they did. Do you have any ideas on that?
I wonder if I have.
Like the radiation lab, why didn't that become another CSIRO?
Well, the radiation lab was for a quite specific purpose, and the people that had been assembled there went back to where they came from, essentially. And
that's true. CSIRO did exist before the war.
Yeah, CSIRO was for a much wider purpose, you know, CSIRO. Actually, in part, it was aided and abetted. I was one of the boosters of the Australians. In fact, when was it? When they first wanted to get a big dish, Taffy Bowen came hunting for money and presented his ideas that they ought to get a big dish. I went to Bush and made the case to him. I don't remember this, about 1950, I guess. And he went, presented it to the trustees. We got the $250,000 for them to start on the dish, Carnegie money. I said, those people ought to be recognized by, in some solid way, for the way they've gone ahead and done things off from, quite a ways from the center of technical activities in the world. And they've done better than all the rest of us.
Yeah.
And this, if our trustees pay that much attention to Taffy, it'll help him get other support too. And he did. He raised that ante of $250,000 in cash from Carnegie to $1.2 million or something like that.
Right.
Got his dish. And so I think a lot of us were boosting for the Australians. We were very pleased that this could happen. And it's best not to try to use money to beat them. At least that was my position. Use money to help them if you could, but don't use the checkbook over here and the big resources of armed forces money, for example, to be sure that we got something bigger and better than the Australians. That wasn't fair.
But of course, in most scientific fields, I think this did happen, that the U.S. was quite dominant.
Yes.
I can't quite understand why radio astronomy was one exception during these first 10 years, anyway.
I don't like to put too much of it on Taffy Bowen, but certainly a good deal of it off the rest of it. Taffy was part of he was part of the Rad Lab, but he went back to his home post, and that's where the Rad Lab gave rise to radio astronomy.
Yeah.
It was through Taffy Bowen in Australia, which was all right.
Yeah.
It's just as good as if he was in Texas. The subject was good.
Yeah.
Now the British, I think they felt they had a lead and they'd better stay with it. Of course, there again.
Well, it was outstanding men. I mean, Ryle and Lovell.
It was just, Yes, Ryle and Lovell, both.
So perhaps that's it. There happened to be these outstanding men in both countries.
This is nearly always the thing that happens when some...
They carried it.
Strong, in the entrepreneur stages of a subject, this is what...
Right.
Does it.
Right.
Later, when you get to the technological phases, make the biggest or the strongest or something, most power, well then other factors enter. But a strong man, really interested and competent, is the answer.
Right.
Or is the answer to Dutch astronomy, I suppose, in large measure. They've had a whole lot of them, but they were associates of Oort. No doubt they interacted and made it strong. Blau is a good man, a lot of others. But and they aren't all Oort students, I don't think, but...
No, but indeed he's the guiding force.
Yeah, well, it's a pilot light. It just keeps going every time there's a chance, right? It stays on fire.
Exactly. He's still going strong, by the way.
Yeah. I think it's just fabulous. I'm so pleased that he's... Because he's always had big, broad-gauge ideas, too.
Well, and Westerbork itself was his...
Yes.
I mean, he saw what Ryle was doing, and he was very impressed with it. He said, we need to do this.
I've watched the Benelux Cross and all these other things go through so many gyrations. I'm awfully pleased that Westerbork has worked out as well as it has. Oh, that represented a great compromise and a considerable disappointment, I think, to Oort, because they couldn't get the money for the big international activity.
But it's still a fantastic instrument.
It's just doing everything the other one would have done.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Well, these are a few highlights of things.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what to...
Thank you very much.
...be interested in.
That is the interview with Merle Tuve on 21st December, 73.